Talk given Sunday, 31st December 1972. All the great religions of the world have given rise to their own particular rituals, ceremonials intended to help the congregation which assembles for these rituals. It is important for us to understand, in some way or other, how these rituals affect us as individuals. If we form part of a congregation and we attend to what is taking place, there is first and foremost a powerful effect upon the whole psyche, both consciously and unconsciously. Now, this effect is of a dual nature. At root, it is of a single nature. It energizes the whole of the psyche. With the result that both the good and the bad aspects in our nature are intensified to a certain extent. Now, obviously, if this were all that happened, the net result would probably be that we would be worse off as a result of this energizing than better off. We would be worse off because, in the ordinary way, in our outward daily life, we are unable to cope with the intensification of all the forces within our own psyche. But in the great rituals of the major religions of the world, there are so many powerful influences for good that they act as a safeguard as far as the stirring up of the difficult aspects of our being is concerned. So, the effect upon the psyche is one of the important aspects of the ritual. There is another aspect to it, a much profounder and an extremely powerful effect. And that is that forces, energies which are transcendent, above and beyond mind as we know it, are released by a religious ritual, provided the celebrant is one who is really skillful, capable, and himself a person who has realized the deep spiritual realities of our existence. Now, where we have a celebrant of that nature, of that skill and ability, he is, in real fact, a magician, It is a magic. It is a magic by which our growth and coming to fruition can be accelerated and is accelerated. What is necessary in this situation is that not only the celebrant, but all those who are participants in the ritual should be people who understand the indispensability of the purity of our own lives. That is our real safeguard. If our own lives are not pure, if in our own psyche there is confusion, there is conflict, there is the passion, the weakness of character for self-indulgence and so forth, then we shall suffer the consequences of that. But if our own lives are pure, and if we are truly concerned with religion in its deep sense, and naturally, spontaneously, give ourselves to the Supreme Reality, then this sort of participation in a religious ritual, which is conducted by the right sort of celebrant, has an extraordinarily powerful influence, not merely for uplifting, but for transforming our whole being. This happens very rarely in the modern world. Very, very rarely. This profound, transformative effect. Simply because, in the first place, where shall we find a celebrant who is equal to this task? We don't know such people. But they do exist. And in addition to finding the celebrant, where shall we find a congregation which is capable of that concentrated attentiveness, that pure and dedicated self-giving, which will enable the celebrant to find no obstruction coming out of the collective psychical state of the congregation, no obstruction to the magic that he is performing. Now, I mention all this for a very simple reason. We have been considering something about the gods of the Rig Veda for the last few meetings. We have dealt with Varuna, who is the embodiment of virtue, the Lord, the moral governor of the universe, and the Lord of the cosmic order in that sense. We have considered Indra, who is regarded as the personal Lord of heaven. We considered Indra in some considerable detail. And we have dealt also with Agni, the Lord of fire. The Lord of fire burns up everything in us. The Lord of fire is responsible for the life-death process that goes on in us from moment to moment. As we all know, ordinary biological living is a process of burning up. Oxidation takes place continuously, besides several other processes. The body burns in order that the light of life may shine. This is a literal fact. And this is a fact which applies to our psychical as well as to our spiritual nature. We burn away constantly. And in that burning, there is light, insofar as we in our inner selves are completely in harmony with that process of burning, primarily because of our own purity of nature. So the Lord of Fire affects this extraordinary burning process, which extends throughout the physical as well as the psychological and the spiritual aspects of our being. These are very deep things to consider very, very carefully for years and years. Meditate upon them and see what comes to light for you yourself in your own way. Because every one of us burns in our own way, individually, uniquely. We do not burn like anybody else. It's not as if we were a collection of just so many 100-watt lamps, which will give out just precisely so much light, etc. Not at all. Each light is a unique individual light, and it's a marvelous light. And this process, in one sense, is a great ritual process. Agni, the Lord of Fire, is one of the three great ritualistic gods of the Rig Veda. The other one is Brihaspati, who is the Lord of Prayer. Now, prayer, if one may relate that word to the Sanskrit Brahma, which means, amongst its other meanings, a prayer which is, the English word used is not a very fortunate word, which is a spell. That is to say, it is something which is intended, again the wrong English word occurs, to compel the gods. It is not a spell in the sense that it compels the gods. It is an act of power dedicated completely to the fulfillment of the high purposes of what we call the gods. So that is the meaning of prayer. And what is its actuality as far as we ourselves are concerned? If there is real prayer, there is no petition for self whatsoever. In the profoundest states of prayer, there is no selfness at all, absolutely none. There is the state of active communion, which is a power that goes out into the entire environment through ourselves. And this again happens individually. And this is a great ritual process. The Upanishads use the word the great sacrifice. Now you see the significance of sacrifice. You can, if you can grasp some of these basic ideas, we will see that the word sacrifice really means making sacred. And it is only man through whom this making sacred can go on and take place on this planet. Only man can do it. Not even the angels and the archangels can do it, as we can do it. And I mention angels and archangels because, for example, in the Judeo-Christian tradition, we have it said that man was made higher than all other creatures, but only one step lesser than the angels. You see? But the angels have no option to do other than be angelic. Just as the demons have no option but to be other than demonic. Man has the option. And because man has the option, he holds an extraordinarily key position in the whole process of evolution and growth and coming to fulfillment where all the kingdoms of nature on this planet are concerned. So now you see, man, the magician. Remember the Magga brotherhood of Zarathustrianism, the Magi, or how do you pronounce it in English? Magi? Yes. But it is the Magga brotherhood, you see, the ones who were themselves holy ones and who carried out this great ritual process. All right. Now, so much in relation to Brihaspati and prayer. And the third ritualistic god of the Rig Veda is the Supreme One, Soma. The great Brahmanical ritual is the Soma sacrifice, as it is called. It is the supreme Hindu ritual right up to our own times. In its external form, it is presented, I'll give it to you extremely briefly and just a thin skeleton of it. In its external physical form, it is said that a plant called the Soma plant is taken, its juice is extracted by its being pressed between stones, that juice is filtered, purified ritualistically, and then the celebrants, usually there are five Brahmin priests, they drink of that soma and become God-filled, enthusiastic, God-intoxicated, as it is said. And whosoever drinks of the soma also becomes God-intoxicated. It is said even that Soma is the god who confers immortality upon all who participate of him. He is certainly said to be a conferrer of immortality upon the gods themselves. Now, do recall what we said in the beginning, that the gods are our creation. The forms of the gods, they are our symbolic pictures to represent real energies which are archetypal forces of transcendent mind. Man, becoming aware of these forces and inevitably becoming aware of them in different ways and in different modes of expression, personalizes, anthropomorphizes them, and raises up the gods. These are the gods. They don't exist as separate beings. They are symbols in our own minds, and they represent real forces, transcendent energies. But because transcendent energies have neither shape nor form nor measurability nor characteristics, they remain everlastingly unknown to us unless we make a picture of them and ascribe characteristics to them, simply because those characteristics represent what happens in our own nature in consequence of becoming aware of these energies. It is important to realize all these things. Otherwise, we will inevitably fall into the trap of imagining gods and angels and archangels as wonderful shining creatures flapping golden wings and flying through the aerial spaces and all the rest of it. That's all very pretty, pretty. Now, these gods live only as long as we live. In fact, less long than we live. That is to say, mankind lives. They live as long as we human beings on the face of the globe bear them in our memory. But as and when the human race forgets those gods are dead. We may forget those gods insofar as we forget them as symbolic representations. But the energies underlying that symbolic representation is a real energy. So they re-emerge as the race changes its conceptions and its pictures. Because the energies are constantly operative. Those never cease to operate. So we give them new names. We have the gods of Olympus, we have the Scandinavian, the Celtic, the Teutonic, the Hindu, and various other gods in all the different so-called pantheons of the world. But these pantheons have existed only for the last 6, 7, maybe 8, 10,000 years. But the human race has existed something like, well, certainly over 1 million years. And what's happened to all the gods who managed affairs before our drop in the ocean of 10,000 years? They have sunk into limbo, completely forgotten. That is to say, the forms have disappeared. Their names have become erased from the book of life, from the records in the book of life. But their reality in the book of life is ever present, simply because they re-emerge under new names. Now we must realize all this. Now this Soma ritual then, the plant, the tree, and the leaves are taken, and the stalk, and pressed between stones, and the juice extracted, and so on, as I have already mentioned to you. This is the external outward form. What is its inner reality? What is this tree? Now remember what we have seen again and again, that in the old scriptures, the tree represents for us, the word tree represents the brain and the nervous system and the spine. This is the tree of life in our own living organism. The tree of life which we, in our ignorant state, in our incomplete, imperfect state, convert into the tree of good and evil. Insofar as we transcend and become completely free of bondage to the dualism of good and evil, this self-same tree of good and evil is now the tree of transcendent life. So the word tree represents precisely that, physically. You can work out all the psychological correspondences, the characteristics of the individual being, what happens in our own inner world of thought and feeling, of intellect and emotion. And going deeper, in our own world, when we enter deeper states of consciousness and become aware of profound truths that are beyond any expression in thought and speech. So you see, this is the tree. And this juice is the amrit, the deathless, without death. That is to say, without death in the sense of death, the deliverer of the wages of sin. It is not death in the sense of mere destruction, that which has not come to fruition, which has not become perfect as it was, as it is intended in the becoming process to become, and therefore is broken up in order that new emergence may be made afterwards. Not death in that sense. It is not death, amrit, is not death in that sense, but it is the reality of death, which is other life. Out of limited being into infinite non-being. Out of dualistic, confused, conflicting consciousness into the pure light, the utter clarity of the enlightened state. And just as the confused state exists only in terms of manyness, and the enlightened state is the one and only, where there are no separations, no distinctions at all, no thine and mine, and so forth. Out of the split-up state into the unified state. That is death, the other life, if you like. And that is not my life or your life. So that we must remember very, very clearly and distinctly that we must not let our confused ideas about personal immortality intrude upon this. Immortality is of the whole, of the totality. Mortality belongs to you and to me, and only mortality belongs to you and to me, and takes place within our limited sphere. But through you and me, this total being, this total ultimate energy, power, call it what you will, works its will, so to say. It's very important to remember this. Otherwise, that poisonous sting of selfness will always wound us to the wrongs, so that we reach the wrong sort of death. That selfness must be out. And then the life-death pulsation, which is the life-other life pulsation, the being-non-being, the finite-infinite pulsation, freely moves through us. And this is the great sacrificial ritualistic process of the entire universe, leave alone you and me as individual creatures. Understand ritual and the magic of ritual in these ways, and you will see, I hope you will begin to see something of the real significance of ritual. So now, if we see that, the ritual which we go through when we go to church or the temple or the mosque or whatever it is only a symbolic process which is intended helpfully to enter more and more deeply into this total ritual, which is the great sacrifice which takes place right through the universe, all the time. This is one of the meanings of the life of God, of eternal God. What other meaning can life have but that? So now, understanding that, Let me read just a few verses from the Rig Veda concerning Soma. Now remember that of the 10 books of the Rig Veda, the whole of the 9th book and about a dozen other hymns from the other books are all dedicated to Soma. And the 9th book has 114 or 15 hymns to Soma. So you will see that Soma holds a very high place. Now, the origin, the celestial origin of Soma is expressed like this. High is thy juice's birth. Though set in heaven, on earth it hath obtained strong sheltering power and great renown. Obviously, all these terms are physical terms, terms which we in our psychophysical life understand. But you have to meditate on them and let the transcendental, the transcendent significance and meaning emerge in your own consciousness. And there is a lovely long hymn in praise of Soma, which is rather too long to read. But I'll go on to another hymn, and this comes out of the 8th book, hymn 68. And it is a particularly important one in connection with one or two points. This here, referring of course to the ritualistic Soma juice and so forth, this here is Soma, never restrained, active, all-conquering, bursting forth, rishi and sage by sapience. Rishi, remember, means he who is a singer of the songs of eternal life. Don't stop at the usual definition given by the ordinary scholar that a rishi is a singer. Otherwise, pop singers might be rishis. All that is here, he covers over. All that is sick, he medicines. The blind man sees, the cripple walks. And remember, these hymns of the Rig Veda are at least 1500 years before the birth of Christ. The blind man sees, the cripple walks by virtue of the activity of the god Soma. Now you see, the god Soma is not merely the god of a ritualistic process. It is not a magic in a transcendentally analogous sense to the magic of a pill which saves life. It is so powerful, so marvelous, that it saves the life of a sick man. It's not merely that. Soma, basically, at root, is the god of inspiration. We know the meaning of inspiration in our ordinary artistic terms and so forth. You get a great inspiration, you write a poem, you compose a symphony, build a wonderful building, or whatever it is, and so forth. We call that inspiration. Consider it this way. Physically, when we breathe in, we call that inspiration. But that inspiration contains that without which the body would perish. We can dispense with food, we can dispense with water for a very long time, weeks, even water for several days. But breath, inspiration. It contains that without which the living organism perishes. Soma is the god of inspiration, which is that without which there'd be no such thing as our spiritual life. This is the meaning of soma. Consider the meaning of this inspiration then. This inspiration really represents that transcendent energy which is creative power. And creative power, you may remember some months ago we dealt with this, is synonymous with creation all the time. The power and what we usually regard and wrongly regard as the consequence of the application of that power, creation, are not separate things. There is no such thing as creative power minus creation simultaneously. Creative activity. So soma represents that sort of inspiration. And this process by which creation goes on, this activity of creation, is the great ritual, the great sacrifice, the great ceremonial magic, and so forth. Now, because it is creative power, when you or I, if you or I are seized with this taken up into this creative state, then we are in that state of inspiration, which is the supreme healer. But do not think, therefore, that, show me how to get in touch with soma, and I'll go about helping 500 blind men in that hospital to see tomorrow morning. You won't, you can't. This has to do with spiritual blindness. And only in so far as the spiritual blindness is linked up with our psychosomatic states and so forth, and provided certain physical conditions hold good and are favorable conditions, maybe even physical blindness could be helped. But the significance of the blind man sees, the cripple walks. The spiritually blind sees truth at last. The one who cannot go on any longer with the spiritual life walks on. In his spiritual life. Have we not time and again experienced this extraordinary pain, this depression, this weariness, so that we felt we'd be glad if life would be over? We've had too much of it. We can't go on anymore. And I don't mean this merely in the realm of our personal sorrow or difficulty or problems or anything like that, but this deep spiritual distress which comes to one. An extraordinary spiritual distress. The mystics have called it by various names, such as the dark night of the soul and so forth. And we lose the power to go on. We lose the will to go on. But let soma work. And lo and behold, you are no longer a cripple. You go on. All the holy ones of all the great religions have been credited with healing powers of this sort. Thou, soma, givest wide defense against the hate of alien men. hatreds that waste and weaken us. Who are these alien men? Who is an alien man? And what is his hatred? An alien is not the foreigner geographically, nationally, or in any such stupid little human way. The alien spoken of here is the one who sets himself deliberately against the stream of life, who denies, first and foremost, the fundamental laws by which he should live, namely the simple moralities. That is the alien. Make no mistake about it. We are concerned with religion, the context of which is transcendence itself. And transcendence is invincibly powerful. If we stir up the power of transcendence, it breaks us, completely shatters us, if we choose to remain impure and to indulge the self. So do bear all that in mind when considering these things very, very deeply. That sort of man, then, is the alien man. And what is his hatred? The inevitable force, energy that goes out of his psyche, which tends to obstruct the workings of transcendence. This is his hate. By that token, each one of us is also an alien man unto himself, because we have this dualistic nature in us. We are still functioning, plucking the fruits from the tree of good and evil. We do not live on that holy manna, the fruits of the tree of life eternal. That's a very different thing. But it is this selfsame tree of good and evil which has to be transmuted into the tree of life. And it is Soma, the magician, the god of inspiration, who transmutes this tree of good and evil into the tree of life. Let me go on to something else now. Everybody associates Soma with a plant, with a juice, and of course all the clever ones of our own age, of this century, try to find out all sorts of wonderful hallucinogenic properties in this juice. And so, of course, they cotton on to various plants which have hallucinogenic effects. Some have, of course, associated Soma with the famous mushroom. So beware when you have mushroom soup, you know. It might be the Soma mushroom, and then you will have wonderful hallucinations. Now, put all that completely aside. The actual ritual which is carried out to this day in India, of course, uses a plant. The Iranians also had the same Soma ritual. Soma is called Homa in Avestan. The S and the H interchange in Vedic and in Avestan. They interchange, you see. For example, what we call the River Indus was the Sindhu River for the Rig Vedic people, and it was the Hindu river for the Iranians. It's like that. See? All right. So, forget all about the physical aspect of it. Now listen. Truth is the base that bears the earth by Surya, that is the sun god, Apollo. By Surya are the heavens sustained. By law, Ritta, that is the eternal order of things, the Adityas, that is the great gods of the Rig Veda, they are called Adityas because they are declared to be the sons of Aditi. And Aditi means the infinite, the unbound, the utterly free. So the children of the unbound, the utterly free, the infinite, are the Adityas, the great gods of the Rig Veda. By law the Aditya stands secure, and Soma holds his place in heaven. Now, by Soma are the Adityas strong, by Soma mighty is the earth. Thus Soma, in the midst of all these constellations, hath his place. And now I want you to listen very carefully. One thinks, when they have brayed the plant, that he hath drunk the Soma's juice, of whom Brahmins truly know as Soma, no one ever tasted. It has nothing to do with drinks. It is this inspiration, this purely spiritual reality, which is realized through you when you, still, silent, with the mind utterly pure and clean, are the vessel through which the waters of eternal life can flow. And that is the real Soma and the real Soma juice, of whom Brahmins truly know as Soma, no one ever tasted. Now there is just one more hymn I'd like to read to you. These are the concluding verses of hymn number 113 of the ninth book of the Rig Veda. And here, one of the other names for Soma is used, Pavamana. Pavamana. O Pavamana, place me in that deathless, undecaying world, wherein the light of heaven is set, and everlasting luster shines. Make me immortal in that realm where dwells the king, Vivasvan's son. Vivasvan's son is Yama. Yama had a twin sister called Yami. And there is a remarkable correspondence between Yama and Yami of the Rig Vedic tradition, Adam and Eve of the Judaic tradition, and Yama's counterpart in the Iranian tradition is Yima. His whole full name is Yim Kshayeta. Now both Adam and Yima, a sister, Yimak. Both Adam and Yima experience a fall, which calls for a redemption. In the Rig Vedic tradition, Yama has no fall. There is a temptation involved in the story of Yama. There is no fall. Yama crosses over death. becomes immortal and is granted lordship over the highest of the three heavens. This is Yama. And he becomes the lord of death. Yamaraja is mentioned also by the Buddha and in the Buddhist tradition. Now Yama is the lord of death. And remember, he is said to be the first of mortals who realizes immortality, crosses over death, and is given lordship in the highest of the three heavens. So, the seer, the poet seer, the holy one who wrote this hymn, says, "Make me immortal in that realm where dwells the king, the highest of the three heavens, Vivasvan's son, where there is the secret shrine of heaven, where there are those waters young and fresh. Make me immortal in that realm where they move even as they list, in the third sphere of inmost heaven, where lucid worlds are full of light. Where they move even as they list." What is this movement? It's not an interplanetary flight. It is moving in the deep states of consciousness. And it's a movement in complete freedom from one state to another. And do remember that in this business of the movement in the deep states of consciousness, we will never understand it clearly if we are troubled with ideas about higher states and lower states, superior states and inferior states. There is no comparison in the realm of transcendence. Comparison belongs to the realm of the many, the differentiated, to the realm of the mortal, the suffering, the realm of that which is born and dies. Comparison belongs to that realm, not to the realm of transcendence. So where they move even as they list, in different profound states of consciousness, and if there is an analytical aspect to it, the difference in the profound states is that one becomes aware of the play of the energies of transcendence in different modes. A simile comes to my mind instantaneously. A great composer can write a fugue. He can write a sonata, a prelude, a ballad. He can compose a symphony. They are all perfect music. You can't compare the one with the other. It's perfection. And yet, there is this extraordinary difference. It is as if paradoxically, it were the difference brought into being by the one and only playing with itself. And we, with our analytical consciousness, of course, give different names to it. But realize, it is all one, where they move even as they list. Make me immortal in that realm of eager wish and strong desire, the region of the golden sun, where food and full delight are found. Now beware of these translations. In that realm of eager wish and strong desire, that is all right. What is this wish and desire? The Upanishads give the secret away quite openly. talking about the Holy One, whose wish, whose desire is the real, the ultimate real, is the Atma, is Brahman itself. That is the wish, that is the desire, the passion, if you like, the utterly pure passion, which is no longer my passion, so to say, but that energy of transcendence itself functioning unhindered and clearly through me. Because transcendence, the infinite, comes to self-awareness through you or through me as individual beings. Otherwise, it hasn't self-awareness. We are, if you like, the brain of the earth. The region of the golden sun, that always typifies the enlightened state, where food and full delight. Now please do not associate this word food with fruit salads and cream or any such thing like that, you see. Food, anna, sustenance, where spiritual sustenance and full delight are found. The delight which is not sensational pleasure, which is not any form of egoistic satisfaction, but the delight which is the bliss, the ananda, that bliss of absolute peace and poise, which we have in Christian terminology as the peace of God that passeth all understanding. And that is one of the most remarkable of the hymns to Soma.